Welcome to the Daily Canon Podcast.
Hello again, listeners. Welcome to another Daily Canon Weekly Podcast. It's a very summery Daily Canon Weekly Podcast. We've had a week of very hot weather in Europe, particularly in London, where we got up to 40 degrees. But it's always hotter in London, generally, in Croatia, where Anita is. How are you, Anita?
Hello. Yeah, we got some London type of rain over the weekend, but it's still pretty hot summer weather here as well.
Yeah, you clever people with air conditioning, which unfortunately we're far too stupid to have in the UK.
We are a bit more used to the higher temperatures and more prepared.
Well, without getting into politics, Britain seems to be specialising in not being prepared for anything at the moment. But I resist going into that particular arena because we could be here for some time, and that's not what you tuned in to listen to. And frankly, there's far too much to talk about in Arsenal land this week. It's been a really full-on crazy week, hasn't it? I mean, this has probably been, in terms of the variety of news and the size of the news, it's probably been the biggest week off season we've had at Arsenal in quite a number of years.
Just crazy. Don't know where to start. I mean, you forget that there was stuff happening last week, not only this crazy weekend that we had, and today more developments. I mean, just stuff for us. I always think of that view from Twitter, from American version of Office, where the
I don't know the American version, so but I know the actor.
Yeah, he goes around and yells, "Oh my God, it's happening!"
Yeah, it's Steve Carell, isn't it? Yeah,
Steve Carell.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of gifts, it's been a very strong week for Arsenal Twitter. You know, you've had Ornstein as a sort of centrifuge for all kinds of insanity spouting off in 100 different directions. So it's been good fun. I mean, it may seem perverse given the size of the other news, but I suppose probably safest dealing chronologically. And let's briefly touch on the slightly mental game against Real Madrid, the final game we played in the States. Were you fortunate enough to actually see the game or any of the game? I mean, obviously it was not a wonderful hour, but it wasn't quite as horrific as some of the others.
No, I haven't. I wouldn't be able to function the rest of the day.
Yeah.
I woke up that early. But yeah, it has been really a crazy, crazy match.
I presume you saw the highlights of the game, though.
Yeah.
I mean, again, whether we, you know, give it any credence or not, it does seem this International Champions Cup preseason trophy bollocks does seem to have generated more competitive preseason games, because obviously Arsenal are slightly ahead of Madrid in terms of their fitness, but that was a bit tasty at times, I thought, that game.
It was definitely a bigger competition than what we had last season before, with playing against Asian 11 or something like that. But it was, I mean, no disrespect to anyone, of course, but it's just a bit more, bigger pressure, more expectations. And I think that even players are a bit more motivated, especially the younger ones who wants to play against Real Madrid.
Yeah, exactly. And it's an opportunity to genuinely test yourself and be a bit more prepared for the season, whereas obviously, as you say, these games against locally combined teams or second-rate teams are they're just fitness exercises and PR exercises, and they don't give you a real indication of where the team's at, either tactically or really in terms of fitness. So it's kind of interesting seeing these tests. And obviously we saw a continuation of the new improved 4-2-3-1 with Aubameyang still coming in off the right. And we saw just how effective that could be early on for Arsenal in this game, didn't we? With two pretty quick fire goals.
Yeah, exactly. A good start. It's like maybe when I think of the Real match later on in the week, I think, are we going to have another season of good half and bad half?
Well, yeah, I mean, with the Real Madrid game, I suppose, as with the Lyon game, we started both games with strong starting 11s, and obviously the raft of substitutions, we got slightly weaker while our opponents brought on better players, or at least players that were better, in Real Madrid's case, better lined up against us. I mean, obviously, how often do you see two red cards in a pre-season friendly as well in the first half? I mean, that was...
Yeah, in fact, I mean, can I just say that when I logged on Twitter to, you know, see the comments and everything, there was absolutely no mention of Real Madrid red card. Everyone was just, oh, stupid Arsenal red card. How is that happen? It's pre-season. Socrates can be trusted in defense, everything like that. And when I went to actually look for the reports and highlights and everything, they actually got the red card before us.
Yeah, quite well, very early on as well, yeah.
I mean, general conclusion among everyone was that the referee wasn't very much up for the standard of the game, but...
Yeah, I mean, I would say that the refereeing question probably doesn't have much danger of refereeing games in a major European league anytime soon. He was a little bit out of his depth. Although, having said that, you know, the Real Madrid red cards, I mean, he'd obviously already booked the guy when he'd taken out Klasnac when Klasnac was potentially clean through and then handballed on the line on a yellow card. It's quite hard for the referee to not do anything about that, really.
Yeah,
although he took
Socrates once, I don't think that it was really...
Yeah, I mean, it was the Socrates yellows were very much being like back in the Premier League, where the Arsenal player gets a yellow card for something the opposition players don't get booked for.
Yeah, exactly.
and it was very obvious that after having given Arsenal, you know, the penalty, which was clearly a penalty, and sending a Madrid player off, he felt very much obliged to not give us anything else for as much of the game as possible. And having seen us kind of apply a bit of pressure to regarding the handball on the line and to make sure Nacho was sent off, Real Madrid then sort of upped the ante on referee intimidation shithousery to a level that we can never quite compete to. and it would seem pretty obvious that the Socrates second yellow was although it probably... You know, it's one of those ones where... Was it a yellow, was it not? You could call it either way, but... It was definitely a decision made by the great and the good of the Madridistas, and because the referee didn't look like he was going to book him until basically 10 Real Madrid players surrounded, or 9 Real Madrid players surrounded him, and suddenly out came the second yellow.
They are good at that in La Liga and yeah.
Well, you know, and they did have, you know, Mr. King shithouse. Captaining the side, I think, Sergio Ramos, and you know, if anyone knows the dark arts, he does. But having said that, it was a very enjoyable game. I mean, from an Arsenal perspective, it was a shame Socrates got sent off, because it meant that we saw a sort of reshuffling. It meant that it prevented at least one kid being able to get on in the second half, which was a shame. We also completely lost control of the match when at half-time, Joe Willock went off and Mkhitaryan dropped back into central midfield. And obviously, Mkhitaryan is not and has never been a genuine central midfielder. And some people accuse him of a lack of effort. It wasn't a lack of effort. It's just he doesn't know how to track runners in a central area because he's never done it. And if you're a player and you're, you know, 30 and you've never done something before and you're suddenly being asked to do it against very high-quality opposition...
It's tough.
Yeah, it is tough. It is tough. But as you would have seen from the highlights, despite giving away a ball a couple of times in slightly cheap area, slightly cheaply, Joe Willock was really, really good again against Real Madrid.
Yeah, he's the highlight of the preseason, I would say.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, really, that allowing us to play a bit more of a press in midfield in the way that we haven't been able to for some time, because he does so with slightly greater effectiveness, well, slightly more aggression than Mesut Ozil does, and with slightly more pace than Ram and Ramsey does. It's a real lesson for those of us who are kind of like trying to predict the evolution of young players, because he's someone that, okay, we knew was around the first team and we knew had promise, but the difference between even last summer and this summer in his physical strength, his power, his assertiveness, his willingness to impose his personality and get into dangerous areas. It's not often for me you see a player improve that much in a year at that age. It's a bit like when Alex Iwobi kind of went from being the guy that we were wondering if was ever going to play for the under 23s to the Arsenal first team, and we're at the Nou Camp in like 15 months. So it gives great hope. You know, obviously there are warnings the other way. We all know about the young players that showed plenty and then never actually really made it. But it's kind of again me are sticking on my hope vibe.
Yeah, I was just thinking that you have been speaking about, you know, the one thing to look forward to in the next season is to see more younger players from Arsenal Academy and both from abroad to get more chances. And I really hope that he will get more chances, because he definitely showed it in all those matches he got to play, even especially against Lyon. That one is more fresh in my memory, so
Well, it happened more freshly, so yeah. But no, you're right, he was excellent against Lyon again. I mean, he was a real threat. Possibly not quite as much in terms of pressing and creating, but certainly in terms of getting into dangerous positions and unsettling the Lyon defence. Yeah, he was fantastic again.
I didn't see why he wouldn't start in some European League group stages.
I think it's very likely they will. I think last season was a little bit early for him and Ketia and one or two others, but certainly in the Europa League group stages and various different cups, we want to be seeing Joe Willock and Eddie Nketiah, and if he stays without, rather than going on loan, Reece Nelson. We want to see them in every Europa League group game. Maybe if we get one really tough one away from home, or we find ourselves needing points, whatever. But you know, as long as our destiny is under our control, there's no real reason for not playing them, because they've shown enough in this preseason, not necessarily consistently, but that they have the ability and, more importantly, the physical development to be able to contribute in the professional game, men's game, rather than just at youth level. So that's something we have to be excited about.
Yeah, and it's a good option from the bench as well in the league and in domestic cups. I mean, that's really nice to have someone, it's a cliche to say, but, you know, younger and ready to, you know, jump in to turn the match around if possible. He doesn't only have his youth and his speed and the physicality, but also the knowledge, the power, the ways of, you know, actually turning the game around.
Yeah. And right on that point, exactly, these players are a little bit different to other players we have in the squad, and therefore give us more tactical flexibility as well. Yeah, options, as you say. You know, it allows us, you know, we know that Emery likes a tactical formation change. And we also know that even within the same formations, you can have the same formation applied very differently depending on how it's made up. You know, if you're playing three at the back and you've got Jenkinson at wing back, that's a very different sort of scenario than if you've got Reece Nelson playing at wing back, for instance. Or, you know, as we saw in the Europa League final, although it was a shit show, we saw how Joe Willock just bringing something different to the table impacted on the match. And so, yeah, I think it's as I've been banging on about, it's very exciting.
Shame there is no one like that for our defence.
Took the words right out of my mouth.
I mean, it's been years.
I mean, it's that thing you generally think back and you think, okay, so the last defender we bought who sort of really is probably of the level that we need on a regular basis was probably Koscielny. I mean, Monreal had two really good seasons, but was a bit mediocre before that, and was mediocre last season. Not sure Bellerin really counts, because we've got him when he was so young. He was really turned into a right back at Arsenal rather than being a right winger. Debuchy looked good for a few months before getting injured.
I mean, Socrates is.
So yeah, he's kind of okay. He's the guy that you know at least has not necessarily the right temperament, but has the right spirit. You know that he's up for a fight, and you always need someone with that capacity in your team. But we also know that realistically, he's only at the level of a first choice defender for a substitute defender for a club at our level.
Yeah, and I just remember now, with his second yellow and red card in the match against Real, I've seen many people mention how the little things he does around the pitch, you know, little shirt pulls and everything like that, but could easily be punished by VAR next season.
Yeah, I'm going to say both him and Xhaka have reminded us that VAR is not going to be their friend.
So that will definitely influence his game a bit.
Yeah.
Because he is an older player and it's hard to change your ways when they used to work so well.
Yeah, and also, you know, that level of aggression that's on the borderline between, you know, good defending and just being a bit thuggish. It is something that we actively wanted because, you know, the rest of our defence was, if I want a better way of putting it, a bit nice to play against.
Yeah, that's good.
You know, I mean, not that they weren't, not that Koscielny hasn't been a great defender and not that even Mustafi is capable of very good performances, but just we all know that the best defenders, unless you're kind of Maldini or you're or possibly a bit like Virgil van Dijk at the moment, someone that's so physically smooth and efficient in your movement that you can kind of be quite physically dominant without having to play on the edge. But most of the rest of the best defenders you can think of around the world throughout history have had that edge to them.
Sergio Ramos as well.
Well, Sergio Ramos has an edge even greater than his ability, which is...
I mean, that sometimes gets him out of the trouble.
Well, you see, I mean, he's going to have so many red cards by the time he retires. could you imagine him playing in England? He'd be sent off every week. but, like, you know, even if you look at the great Arsenal defences of the past, or you look at Atletico Madrid, I mean, Jesus, everyone talks how wonderful their defence is. They're all perfectly happy to break the rules as and when required.
Every moment possible.
You know, I mean, that's one of the things that, just going off Arsenal for a moment, it's one of the things that's going to be interesting to see the evolution of Matthias de Ligt, who's gone to Juventus, obviously.
Yes.
You know, incredibly talented, very physically gifted, excellent on the ball, strong, not super quick, but quick enough. But one thing he was exposed in the Champions League is he doesn't yet have that physical edge to his game. You know, he's got a lot of physical gifts, but he hasn't got a physical edge, and was allowed to be bullied a bit against Spurs. You know, they just brought on that Carlos Llorente, and suddenly Ajax couldn't cope defensively. But if there's one place where you're going to learn how to pick up some defensive edge, Serie A. particularly as he's going to be having to learn from, you know, Bonucci and Chiellini.
Masters.
and possibly, if he's still around in some capacity, Barzagli. You know, these are guys who know how to shit house, but without being as stupid as a Sergio Ramos shit house. Yeah, so of course, as well as any physical issues in terms of aggression that we may not have without Sokratis, we're still at that situation of being very unsure what our central defensive makeup is for the season ahead. It seems that the manager is determined to give Callum Chambers a chance in pre-season. I mean, what do you think about that?
I don't mind. I mean, I think that we definitely have to give him a try, especially if we don't get any other incomings. And I think it could be silly to send him alone somewhere again, because even though Fulham weren't the best team last season, but he was their best player. And I think that he did okay when he was at Arsenal the season before as well. So why not give him a try?
Yeah, I mean, that's it's unless they manage to succeed with this attempt to get, rumoured attempt to get Daniele Rugani on loan from Juventus, who Wenger has tried to buy sort of every summer for about the last 5-6 years. but he chose to go to Juventus ahead of us, which is probably fair enough if you're Italian, you know, winning the league every year, isn't it? But obviously with De Ligt coming in, his opportunity is going to be limited. But if we don't succeed in getting a centre-back in on loan, which seems to be the plan at the moment, then it is very much a case of make, do and mend, particularly as we still don't know what's going to happen with the Koscielny situation. There seems to be no movement on that one way or another.
I kind of stopped counting on him already because that's just the impression that I've got from the club and from everyone, that he needs to play with under-23s and not really in the first team at all.
Yeah, I mean, certainly Emery's taken a fairly pragmatic approach, hasn't he? He seems to be pretty clear about the fact that, you know, the club and Koscielny are talking and I'll deal with whatever happens come the other side of that. But, yeah, so it's sort of... it looks like our defence, starting central defence at the start of the season, is going to be that dream team of Mustafi and Sokratis, with Chambers as first change, which is slightly terrifying, obviously.
I mean, just thinking about it, I'm not a hater, but Mustafi really makes me angry sometimes. I still think that booing him, you know, the whole stadium booing him, I'm not seeing the point particularly, because obviously he will stay here. He was practically advertised around to be sold. And now, if we do get to sell him, yeah, that would be okay, great. We are getting rid of a not really good player, but we get a big hole in the defense that will be hard to fill. Even though he's not up to standard and definitely not what we would want and need in our defense.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, fundamentally, it comes down to a bit of a numbers game. I mean, the whole Koscielny situation has definitely thrown a spanner in the works for us all, hasn't it?
Totally unexpected.
So, you know, on that front, obviously, we've bought, since we last spoke, a central defender, but we don't get to have him for a year. I mean, what did you make of firstly the coverage around his signing, and then the signing as a whole? I mean, I know we talked about it when we all assumed it was going to happen, but just now you've probably, you know, we've all seen a bit more about the player, and we've seen him sort of being unveiled in some capacity. Have your thoughts evolved on the subject at all?
As I mentioned before, I was a bit skeptical about this deal, because it seems there's a lot of money for a pretty young player, and to get him back alone to France for another season, to, you know, not have him available at all until next season, it really seemed like an odd move. But I've read the explanation that Alison Lane gave about that, and he said, like, it's actually a good move, because he's a massive prospect. We have all seen all the reports and all the comments about him. He definitely could be the next big one in future. And perhaps having him on loan in France for another season is not such a bad decision for him and for us in future. It is not really good for this season, but for future, let him, you know, grow a bit longer. I always say that, like, players from Croatian League, they always leave the league as soon as possible, and way, way too young, way too early. So on that note, it's okay, I can, you know, get over it, that we are spending money and getting a central guy that won't be with us until next season. But eventually, for future, I'm excited. I'm gotten over my nervous feeling about this transfer.
Well, you'll be shocked to know that I'm suitably positive about it. I mean, there's a few different reasons. One, despite his incredible promise, both physically and technically, and his great emergence at Saint-Étienne, he still only had basically half a season of top-flight experience in France, or possibly just a couple of games shy of half a season's top-flight experience. And we all know that Ligue 1 is not at the same level of challenge as the Premier League in terms of just the physicality and the strength in depth across different teams. You know, in France, there are going to be some games, if you're playing for a decent team, you're going to have quite an easy ride of it. Whereas in the Premier League, there's only ever three or four teams each season that you kind of feel relaxed playing. And even then, that might not be wise.
Especially at Arsenal.
Indeed. And so, it's hard to think that he'd be ready to make a significant contribution at Arsenal this coming season. Or rather, that there's not enough evidence to be confident that's the case, I guess. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, for me, it's more, in a way, while our defensive situation is so up in the air, is it the ideal environment to be bringing a young player who's just trying to prove themselves as a professional into? You know, if we had a Sol Campbell to stick him alongside, then I'd be much more inclined to try and spend a few more quid and get him in straight away. But the fact is, we all know that Mustafi gives nervous breakdowns to his defensive partners. We know that Sokratis is perfectly capable of picking up a yellow card or giving away a penalty at any given moment. We all know that Callum Chambers himself is trying to prove himself as a potentially a Premier League defender. Rob Holding is going to be coming back from injury, but not immediately. And then you're kind of looking at either Koscielny, if they don't end up getting any money for him and he ends up staying, limping around and sulking, or you got Nacho Monreal, who can do a job at left back if alongside a proper centre back. Sorry, can do a job at centre back if he's in a back three alongside other centre backs of some stature. So expecting a young player to flourish in that environment in a new country, when he's so inexperienced, I think might have been too big an ask. I mean, we've seen how Mavropanos had that one really impressive game when he first started, but since then has looked a bit of a bucket of nerves when he's been in the team. Partly because he's been playing alongside the aforementioned.
I mean, when you go through our defense, like you just did, it's just kind of depressing.
But on the flip side of depressing, because I'm always here to bring the positive, we have to look at other signings coming in and what they represent, not just in terms of the numbers and the quality, but also stylistically for the squad. You know, there was a lot of criticism last year for Unai Emery being perhaps overly conservative at home against small teams. And just looking at the players that we've brought in and are trying to bring in, it's clear that that balance is shifting a little bit in terms of where the priorities lie.
A little bit, yeah.
So perhaps we're going to be like the, you know, a bit like Tottenham under Ozzy Ardiles, where it's just like insane attacking football and no fucking defence. But at least it'll be more enjoyable than last year.
Tactic, let's score more than we can see.
Yeah. Kevin Keegan for the win. But, yeah, I mean, first off, I guess we have to touch on Dani Ceballos, or Ceballos, if you try and butcher Spanish. I mean, before he turned up at Arsenal, did you know a lot about the player?
No, I haven't seen him very much.
Because I know he's someone that obviously, another one that Wenger was linked with and chose to go to Real Madrid, a European super club, ahead of us at the time when he left his first team, which again, entirely understandable, and probably at that point in time wasn't an immediate position of priority for us. But yeah, he's someone who is a sort of deeper midfielder, was running Betis's midfield as an 18, 19-year-old. And then has obviously been very good for the Spanish under 21s. Has struggled a bit to impose himself at Real Madrid, but I guess if you've got Toni Kroos, Luka Modric, Isco, Asensio, and others blocking your path, it's quite. Right. Yeah, at Madrid, he's always going to have to fit around other people, isn't he?
Yeah, definitely. It's a good long move for him and for us.
Yeah, I mean, what do you make of? You know, I think perhaps his cameo in the Emirates Cup game might have silenced a few people, but there were quite a lot of people who were kind of like, oh, we're taking someone on loan, you know, so why are we doing it?
Nurturing the Real Madrid player for this season. I've seen some comments about that. I really don't mind. There were people listing all the failed loans we had so far, with the most recent one being from La Liga,
yeah.
which was really a total fail. But I mean, I guess it's okay. He seems like a really good player, can fit in our midfield, can kind of fill in the Ramsey hole there.
I mean, I was saying to Paul last week, I think he can do some of the same things as Ramsey in terms of linking in the final third, but I think what he actually brings us, not the same player, not the same attributes, you know, not as two-footed, not slightly quicker, blah, blah, blah. But I think he can bring us some of what Santi Cazorla used to bring us when he was playing in central midfield, perhaps not quite the same level of control, because Santi being so incredibly two-footed and having being so good at turning out of tight spaces.
Which is a good video.
But yeah, but Ceballos is quicker and taller and possibly is able to transition play a little bit quicker. Is certainly very good at playing quick combination football, and we haven't had anyone who can really play in a central midfield role since Cazorla's legs exploded, for want of a better way of putting it. Who has anything like that degree of skill set? You know, Xhaka doesn't have the athleticism or ability to beat a man. Torreira is a very tidy footballer, but not as progressive. We're still finding out what Guendouzi is, but he seems probably more likely to have a future in a very slightly deeper role, more of a six than an eight, if you will, to use the numerical parlance. So I'm really excited about what Ceballos can bring to us, because I think he's exactly the type of midfield player this squad has a hole for, partly because he can do a number of different things. I think again, he's a perfect player for Unai Emery because he can flourish in slightly different roles in different systems, whether it's is that kind of third central midfielder that's more attacking in a 4-3-3, or maybe as a number 10, or maybe as a number 8 in the two.
That's just what I wanted to say. It seems that Emery really has some kind of plan what to do with him, how to use him, because according to reports, he called him up and he convinced him to sign for us and not for Spurs. So that makes me a bit more confident as well.
Yeah, we don't know how true it is, but there's rumours that there's some stipulation in the loan deal about if he plays 30 games this season for us, we get first refusal if Madrid agree to sell or something akin to that. I've heard different theories, either that or there was 30 games, he guaranteed 30 games or you know, a percentage of, depending on fitness. Mm-hmm. As part of the deal, in other words, Real Madrid were only let him going to come to us if he was definitely going to get game time. So that again suggests that there is a clear plan for him, and I think we saw enough in just the little cameo at the end of the Lyon game to see exactly how seamlessly he can fit into with some of the other players in the squad, because he looked really bright, and did more in that than Denis Suarez managed in 6 months. I mean, it helps if you actually take a player on loan who's fit, unlike two of the last four loan deals we took on. Perhaps he may even be better for us than in the legend that is Yossi Benayoun.
Yeah, he's the only loan deal I remember that was really good for us. And he looks genuinely excited to be here.
Yeah,
it could just be PR talk, but I mean, it's nice to see.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly true that in this, we've had our kind of expectations slightly moved in this transfer window, because there's been so much gloom around Arsenal. If you're going anywhere near Arsenal Twitter, there's been so much kind of just utter misery for the last couple of months, and you know. As Raoul Sanier, who very smugly said at the end of the season, you know, Arsenal is a name that still carries a lot of weight with players. Players want to come to play for this club, despite not being, you know, even though at that point they thought we were going to be in the Champions League. And we've certainly been proved that that's definitely the case, you know. I'm sure Dani Ceballos had other options. you know, a player of that talent that is going to be available for loan is going to have options to go to. And of course, you know, without getting ahead of ourselves, because the deal hasn't been done yet at time of recording, we're recording this on Monday evening, listeners, we have the bombshell transfer potential thing, which I've enjoyed seeing social media going batshit crazy about, I have to admit.
I mean, that was just... You remember when we were linked with Le Mans together? It was last summer or summer before?
Summer before. Yeah,
when it came out and Dad was going crazy for this, with Pepe now, yes.
Well, the thing is, with Le Mans, we knew we had the money to make it possible, because obviously we all thought Alexis Sanchez was going to go for 60, 70 million, and we didn't know we were going to buy Aubameyang. Whereas in this case, obviously, who has been putting information has done such a good job of making it appear like we have no money. And of course, most football fans forget that most football deals, as you and I discussed a couple of weeks ago, as you pointed out, are structured.
Yeah.
So nobody pays, you know, or very rarely do people pay the whole whack for a player up front in one payment, particularly not for a big transfer. So there's always ways of doing things. Anyone who's played any football manager recently knows this, you know.
I haven't played and I know that.
Exactly.
And Silvan mentioned on our Slack chat that the FFP rules are really strict in French league and they're really paying attention to that. So actually the deal that we have allegedly agreed with Lille fits them much better than what they had suggested from Napoli and others. Paying in installments over the next few years is much better for them regarding all those rules that they need to follow.
Yeah, exactly. It gives them more flexibility going forward, because if, as via the FFP system, you know, particularly if it's applied as strictly as it is there, if you've got the money now, you've kind of got to spend it now or within a couple of years. Whereas obviously the longer the payments are stretched out, the more flexibility that gives you in terms of spending the money when you want. Because you can either write off whatever you spend against those same installments as they come in, or you can choose to spend that money at a later date. Whereas obviously normal FFP rules mean you've got a limited time scale. You know, I think it's every 3 years. It varies slightly from country to country. That kind of you're being slightly dictated to by the rules in a way that this gives them more flexibility. And of course, that's much better for Arsenal, and is essentially the reason why Arsenal are going more down this avenue rather than coughing up a larger bid for Wilfried Zaha, because Palace made it pretty clear that if they're selling Zaha, they want the money now. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Even though the Arsenal Q&A, I think it was on Thursday, right? They both mentioned that ridiculous number of 40 or 45 million came from. They never mentioned that number, of course they didn't. And everyone is talking about it. Who says that that's only the money that is available? So even then, I started thinking, okay, they have something planned, something up their sleeves.
Well, we were saying before, weren't we, you know, in his statement, Josh Kroenke came out and was saying, you know, we should be excited about the transfer business. And it's like, well, that gave me a lot of heart, because it's like, he's not stupid enough to say that unless they've got something planned.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at that stage we thought it was Zaha, and who knows, you know, if the Pepe deal collapses, it may yet be Zaha, but it looks quite unlikely at this stage. But it's pretty clear that, you know, that was also repeated effectively by Unai Emery in one of the post-match press conferences in America, saying how, you know, the club was looking at buying somewhat expensive people. So we knew that there were things in the pipeline. Although we'll get onto the fan Q&A later, because I had that on my list of things to talk about.
Sorry, I'm messing with your plans.
No, not in the slightest. Not in the slightest. You're flagging it up as something which is very, very relevant indeed. But I just want to sort of talk a bit more about Nicolas Pepe first, just while we're on the subject.
I have to say, the other day, totally unrelated to Arsenal, I was browsing Facebook newsfeed and saw one Croatian football-related site post kind of, you know, like a table of stats from last season from Ligue 1, and Pepe was either second or third on all the, you know, important stats like passing, creative chances, goals, assists, and everything like that. And then mentioned in the caption that he was the only player in the top five leagues to have 20 or more goals and 10 or more assists last season. The second player.
Yeah, the second. We all know who the first was. Yeah.
The other one being Messi.
Messi, obviously, yeah.
Hard to compare, but... Yeah. And yeah, when I saw that the little chart and stats and everything, I left a comment. I don't really do that a lot. And I was just saying I put Pepe over Zaha anyway. But I doubt that my guys from North London will be able to bring him, because he is way too expensive. And then yesterday I went back to, you know, leave some really, really happy emojis that comment when the news broke out, because I didn't think that they would be able to, you know, do that transfer, because the rumors were 78 million, something like that.
Yeah.
It seems really...
Well, particularly when you're looking at the teams that were linked with him, it was, you know, Man United, Liverpool, PSG, then later Napoli. But you know, it was teams that you're thinking, well, we can't compete with them financially.
Yeah.
Napoli's obviously a different beast. They obviously don't have as much money to spend as the previous three. And I guess PSG, due to their inability to offload Neymar, I suspect if they had sold Neymar, then Pepe would be a PSG player already. Because we know that they were kind of quite heavily making inquiries in the area, but inquiries mean nothing unless you put in a bid. And as you say, you know, Europe-wise, his stats were great, and it's worth remembering that he was playing as a right winger as well, and still managed to score. I mean, I think 7 were penalties out of the 22 goals. So, but it's still 15 from open play from the wide position is nothing to be sniffed at.
And 11 assists.
Yeah, exactly. And in a team that was overachieving, you know, it's worth bearing in mind, in France, only Kylian Mbappe scored more goals last season. And hey, we don't need to. And also, Kylian Mbappe playing in a totally dominant team, whereas Lille were a team that massively overachieved compared to their previous previous levels of performance. Of course, there is the risk with Pepe that... the plus side is his trajectory of statistics keeps increasing. The downside is that he hasn't got that much of a track record of really great figures. This season before, he got, I think, 11 goals and 4 assists or something akin to that. And then the season before that, the numbers were far from impressive, but he was playing for a pretty weak Angers team. So we have to hope that trajectory is indicative of future improvements rather than being a spike in his career. But, I mean, I'm guessing you've probably gorged on YouTube compilation videos.
Yeah. Skills. How exciting a player he is. Yeah, I'm really hoping that it does go through. And yeah, it looks really, really good. Exciting. As you mentioned before, the transfers that we are making now really makes us more excited about the next season.
Yeah, and I think it's not just, again, numbers when it comes to a player like Pepe, it's the skill set, isn't it? Because he clearly possesses qualities that we don't have. Firstly, he's left-footed, so, you know, we've got very few left-footed footballers in our team. But, you know, genuinely, that gives us a slightly different threat when we've got a lot of people who are happy going down the right and the outside. If you've got someone from the right coming in on their left, that gives you more interchange options. He's also clearly an extremely composed finisher. That's one thing you see from all his goals. He seems to have fairly icy veins in front of a goalkeeper, which is a skill which is rare in any level of football. But also his dribbling ability. But what makes him very different prospect to Zaha, and it's not to say that he's necessarily a significantly better player than Zaha, I don't know if he is, but Zaha's great skill is dribbling, top speed, direct lines, running. Whereas Pepe's strength, in a way, for a team like Arsenal, might be a better fit simply because his great strength is going between slowing the game down and speeding it up. You know, you see in all those compilation videos, particularly some of the more interesting ones that don't just focus on the goals, you see lots of clips of him standing a defender up, don't you? And then from a standing start, accelerating out from it and then breaking into space. The other thing that I find really exciting about him as a player, and you know, I noticed all the way through last season, looking, you know, I was watching quite a lot of highlights of the French league, that he's really got a great awareness of where his teammates are. which is why he creates for others as well. And I think that comes due to his ability to either go quick or slow down, because I think it reflects the fact that he's got a slightly more of a picture in his head about what's going on around him. So he's a threat off the ball and on the ball, and also as a creative impact. So, yeah, I mean, hey, it hasn't gone through yet, touching wood. And
let's open flight rather, see where he is.
Yeah, well, exactly.
And I just want, like, the business side of this transfer, when I was comparing that to Zaha. Yeah. Zaha does have more experience in Premier League, obviously, but Pepe has that this resale value as well. He's only, what, 24?
Yeah, he's just turned 24, yeah.
So, yeah, really a lot of possibilities there as well.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, that's from a business model, it makes more sense. I mean, Zaha is obviously a player who's less likely to, if he were to come to us and succeed, he'd be less likely to then want to go on to bigger things. But because he's an Arsenal fan and he's a Londoner and he wants to stay in London and all the rest of it, whereas Pepe may be thinking that we're the intermediary between Barcelona and Real Madrid, but that depends very much on how teams evolve over the next few years. Quite where Barcelona are going to be once Lionel Messi finally hangs up his boots is hard to predict, because so much of their success has been predicated on his utter brilliance. But yeah, as you say, from a strategic perspective, from a club strategic perspective, it makes much more sense to be bringing in Pepe, because he's got three years younger than Zaha, and is likely to command less wages in the short term, and is more likely, as you say, to be an attractive asset to other teams going forward if we get to that point. It may also reflect, be an illustration of one of the reasons why we were, knowing that this was an option, was one of the reasons why Javier Michi was allowed to go to Hamburg. I don't know if this has come into your sphere of awareness, but the under-18s, under-23s winger Javier Michi, very highly thought at the club, had a brilliant first half to last season, picked up an injury, he was ahead of Bukayo Saka in the pecking order and seen as a sort of almost comparable to Emil Smith Rowe in terms of talent levels, really quick, left-footed right winger, etc. So stylistic comparisons with Pepe. But he was refusing to sign a new contract.
Yeah,
had his head turned, was targeted initially by Bayern Munich. He's gone to Hamburg for $2.5 million plus unspecified sell-on percentage agreements.
And he eventually gets sold to Bayern and wins player of the season.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's a lot of Arsenal fans at the moment going, is it Hamburg behind this deal, or is it Bayern Munich behind this deal, like they were with Serge Gnabry when he left us? And the fact
you hear Bundesliga, you think Bayern.
I mean, it's sort of, the fact is, it doesn't make much difference whether Bayern got anything to do it or not, because in Germany, everyone apart from Leverkusen and Dortmund is basically Bayern's bitch anyway. Because you look at the signings Bayern make, and they frequently buy the best players from rival teams for less than their market value. And you're like, I don't understand how this works. Have they got like a dirty dossier on all the other football clubs or something, of blackmail material? Because you see the prices that Bayern play for their players from other German teams, and you're thinking, they could have got twice as much selling that player to a British club or to a Spanish club or to even to an Italian club. But yet they're all these, the best young talent in, and it's only Dortmund that are, and to a degree Leverkusen, who's kind of standing in their way of just owning all the best players to come out of German football. So if he's good enough, he will end up at Bayern probably. it's slightly...
And score against Arsenal.
Yeah. I mean, it's slightly sad because he is an Arsenal fan, but he obviously had his head turned in a significant way. I mean, we've been talking a lot about this pathway thing, and hence the promotion of Freddie Ljungberg to create that pathway and Edu's role in making young players feeling like there is a future for them. But for whatever reason, all of that has been completely ignored by Amici, it seems. And so it makes it clear why he didn't go on the European tour and why he didn't play in some pre-season friendlies, because the club knew that he was out leaving, basically. Interestingly, the other player in his same age or similar age group who hasn't signed a new contract yet is Tyrese John-Jules, who is very much being integrated and is very much being given minutes in these pre-season games, and is kind of clearly the club are more prepared to take a risk on him and feel they're more going to be more able to convince him to stay. I don't know how much of him you've seen, but he's a player that I'm very excited about. Again, it's far too early to project whether he's going to make it at the top level, but he has an unusually variable skill set. He's a centre forward, but he's come very comfortable dropping off. He can play wide. Excellent finisher, very calm in goal scoring situations. And you know, we've got a really good crop of strikers at the club as well, because you look, obviously we've got Lacazette and Aubameyang, who are really very high level, and Nketiah's hasn't proven anything at the top level, but we've seen even in we knew before but we've seen this pre-season that his movement is top draw. He just needs to improve perhaps the composure in key moments sometimes.
Yeah, I was so sad for him when he missed that chance against Leon Ireland.
Yeah. Mind you, there was there's a lot of missing chances by not very much against Leon. I mean, it's one of those games that when you sort of looked at the final score, because I watched it back later on one of those kind of internet kind of find all matches live channels. And it was kind of like, how the fuck did we lose that?
On highlights on Arsenal player, there was practically no goal chance for Leon whole first half.
Yeah, they didn't. And even in the second half, they got the two goals and they had one shot from Aouar off the bench and a shot from Depay. And that was about it.
Those goals were just so Arsenal.
yeah. Not picking people up and not playing offside line. Although Mustafi got blamed by loads of people for the offside.
I think it was
offside as well. But even if it wasn't offside, it wasn't Mustafi's fault. He just drew attention to himself by waving his hands in the air to try and get the linesman's attention without realising that Maitland-Niles was deeper behind him.
he loves waving his hands in the air.
Yeah. I read some...
But that whole second goal was just more ridiculous. We were thinking, yeah, we were up 2-1 when Martinelli scored that goal. And then, 20 seconds later, it's actually 2-1 for Leon.
and also, it was one of our favourite referees disallowing the goal as well. There seemed to be some disagreement about whether it was offside or whether he thought it was a handball. There didn't seem to be a lot of clarity on that one, but given the speed at which Leon scored afterwards, it wasn't really analysed that moment, which is a real shame for Martinelli, because he looks like he's got something, hasn't he? He's got a directness and a goal threat to him, which is
interesting. Yeah, he's quite inconsistent as well.
Yeah, indeed, yeah. And he also had that one where he beat about five players against Fiorentina and put it just past the post.
Obviously, he will also get some chances, probably, again, in Europa League group stages.
Yeah, I mean, the club seem to make it very clear he's going to be in and around the first team squad, so they've clearly got high hopes for him. And then even beyond those players, if Pepe comes in, that's another significant goal threat. And then you've got, as I say, Nketiah, then you've got Nelson, who we know hasn't proven anything really at this level, but we know he's got goals in him because we've seen them at under-23 level, we've seen it in Germany. Willock has developed a goal threat in the 23s and is certainly getting into positions. And then you look further back, you've got John-Jules, already mentioned, who's a very talented young attacking player. And then even at the under-18s, or probably he'll probably be breaking into the 23s this year, but they've got Flo Balogun, who in the one preseason friendly he played, the under-23s played a friendly against Barnet. And Balogun got a hat-trick in the first 20 minutes. Wow. And there are some fairly shaky cam but decent quality footage you can find on YouTube, and or at least on the internet. I can't remember where I found it, but wow, were they well taken goals. I mean, this is a guy whose goal scoring record at youth level is as good as Nketiah's, who was described on Instagram by sometime last season by Aubameyang as just used fire emojis. And if you see his hat trick against Barnet, you can see why. And what's really exciting is because there's been lots of young strikers coming through at Arsenal didn't make it. People like Chubrak, Pom, and Benikofobi, who were goal scoring beasts at the under 18 level, but were often very reliant on their pace and power. Whereas I think the current crop coming through have got slightly more deftness to their game, and therefore have got slightly more ability to translate for their game to translate to a higher level. I mean, hey, it's early days, and we'll see.
No defenders,
actually. No, well, yeah, not really. I mean, Zeke.
Under 18, sounds.
Well, Ballard's gone on loan to Swindon. He's someone that's been written off at every level, but has managed to overcome. So he's certainly got the personality for it. Zeke Medley needs to tighten up his game before he's going to be anywhere near being first team ready for anything. But has a lot of raw potential given his size and pace and technical capacity. But lower down the ranks than that, there isn't a lot. There isn't a lot. I mean, we all know that defenders take a lot longer to mature on the whole, which is why you get 30 or nearly 30 million for Saliba and 70 million for De Ligt, because defenders who are ready for first team football anywhere really at that age are just really, really rare. And you look around all the big clubs, most big clubs don't produce their own centre halves, because by the time you've got players who are old enough to be ready to play centre half at a big club, they've had to go and play somewhere else in the meantime to be able to make those mistakes at the lower level. And is the way that Wenger always used to say about, you know, young players will cost you points, and nowhere is that truer than in defence. I have to mention this just because it's like totally fucking random, really. Which is, what do you make of the Sami Khedira links?
Did those happen only because he was at the Emirates watching the match?
Well, there was.
I've seen the photo.
Yeah, there was a rumor that one publication came out with last week that everyone instantly went whatever, and then he was seen at the Emirates match, and everyone's suddenly going, hang on a minute, maybe this is a thing. And now loads of news outlets are running with it, all on the basis of basically this one original story and the fact he was at the match.
We were linked with him before.
Yeah, about 10 years ago. And then again about 5 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, do we
need him? It's a really strange rumour, because you're kind of thinking, where does he play in this Arsenal team? You know, do we have the numbers have we already got too many players in our squad to bring another one in that isn't going to be first choice? You know, just in terms of meeting our obligations, in terms of squad number limitations, and we still haven't managed to sell anyone. So theoretically, Mohamed Elneny will be back in a couple of weeks. Recovering from the trauma of the corpse on his dad's patio. Did you hear about that?
That's so random. It's been really a crazy, crazy week for Arsenal.
Yeah, I mean,
dead body.
Yeah, apparently the theory is now that the guy was trying to steal electrical cables and electrocuted himself.
Oh, wow.
Which is kind of tragic, but yeah, there's a bit of a head fuck. I'm not even going to say anything further about the Sami Khedira stories, because they seem so weird. But I suppose maybe the condition of like, yeah, we'll let you take Regani on loan, but you have to take Khedira off our hands too.
Yeah, only that.
And then, as you say, you know, the mentalness of the week is still because we had the utterly batshit crazy Kolasinac boxing off knife-wielding psychopathic thugs.
It's Balkan. You can leave Balkan, but it stays inside you. they should have known better than to pick a fight with him.
Well, I have read, quite a few different people, whether on the internet or elsewhere, over the last week, basically saying, yeah, Bosnians, you do not fuck with Bosnians. Yeah. They have whatever you throw at them, they have seen and been through worse.
Exactly. that just looks scary, and it's really brave of him to, you know, go and fight. Obviously, that was just his instinct, you know, to react like that right away. But did you see the size of that knife?
Yeah. Because you see the first clip, it looks kind of like slightly harmless and comic because you got the two guys running away from him. Then particularly the second guy who nearly falls over running away from him. And then you see the still photo of the fucking knife and you think, Jesus Christ. I mean, you can understand why they were so fucking surprised that he tried to fight back. But yeah, I mean, scary shit. You know, we've heard a few times recently of footballers being threatened or kind of held at knife point. You know, it happened with Andy Carroll, I think, at West Ham, and one or two others. And we know that it's these moped gangs targeting high value things. I mean, there's been a lot of reaction on the internet, and you know, needless to say, there are people going, "Oh my God, London's like the most scary fucking place in the world." And it's like, well, no, because one, you get crime gangs in every country in the world, pretty much.
Yeah.
But also, you know. Yes, you're more likely to be a target for crime if you're driving very expensive cars and wearing expensive clothes and expensive jewellery and what have you. If people basically know you're rich, particularly as these little scroats feel like they're so left behind by society, they've got, you know, the consequences. You know, if they get arrested and locked up, it's not a big deal to them. Obviously. The two players didn't play at the weekend, and you know, you'd be surprised if there wasn't some residual trauma from that. Because apparently, after the footage we saw, then these guys chased them down the road in their vehicle for like 15 minutes until us all ran into the Turkish restaurant which they frequent. And obviously, as soon as these guys went and tried to follow them into the Turkish restaurant, then all the Turkish waiters come out with their fucking knives and shit. And it's a bit like when we had the riots in London. However many years ago, and you know, 7 or 8 years ago now it was, and you know, people were, gangs of youths were smashing things up, and then they tried to attack certain areas, and it was the Turkish areas and the Bangladeshi areas where they got nowhere because basically loads of fucking restaurants, and so these guys are all working with like 10-inch knives, and they just come out, stand outside their shop with their assorted weaponry, and go, "Yeah, come on then." But yeah, scary shit. And I mean, the story, the latest of the story I've heard is that they've got some personal security now.
Totally understandable.
Yeah, entirely understandable. And frankly, if you're earning, if like Ozil, after you're taking home 150 grand a week after tax, you can afford some fucking bodyguards. But it's, you know, they shouldn't need them. And it is scary the way that footballers are now being overtly targeted. And scary to see that Kolasinac's instinct, although it may have turned out to be the right thing under the specific circumstances, but it still put him in a certain degree of danger.
I just love just reading all the truth and everything about making the captain. No one fights it for us, and that's just. We didn't know that he is a badass with the nickname the Hulk and everything.
Yeah.
But now off the pitch as well.
He's been getting a lot of love. Did you see the comments from like there's an American Deontay Wilder, American world champion boxer? He apparently saw the footage, and he was like, "Yeah, his footwork's really good. You know, we could make something out of him. We don't know how we've got to see him throw a hook first, but yeah."
maybe something to think about after the footballing career.
I mean, I don't think it's a great surprise to anyone that he's a hard bastard. He looks like a hard bastard. Although I hope that any difficulty experienced this season is just in trying to get better at tracking runners from wide areas rather than having to find himself in situations like that. And that's not me trying to take the piss out of him, you know, it's just a thing that he's reminded us, I suppose, in a very unusual way of some of his qualities: loyalty, strength, bravery. I mean, if Kieran Tierney comes in, then he's going to have a challenge, isn't he?
Yeah, definitely. He hasn't fight it out with him.
Particularly as Tierney's still coming back from injury.
Like, before every match, let's fight it out. Who will start?
Well, that was some of the stories on the internet, wasn't it? Going out. The reason we haven't put another bid in for Tierney is because now everyone's scared of Kolasinac.
Yeah.
But, I mean, have you heard any more in the last couple of days about the Tierney thing? You know, we're getting Arsenal have pulled out. Arsenal are going to make another bid. It's imminent. It's not going to happen. Everyone's just
lots of really contrast stories going around. Like, we have cooled off our interest. Oh, we are preparing the, what, third or fourth bid now? Who knows? We'll see. I mean, I get the impression that it will happen again.
That's your gut feeling. I was about to ask. I think so too, simply because, again, for the player, even though he's not desperate to leave Celtic by any stretch, this is an opportunity that might not be there next summer. And so he's going to want it to happen. And Arsenal, you know, we know Arsenal like the player. We know that the financial difference is again, it's about add-ons rather than about specific amounts. So there's bound to be some room for negotiation. And frankly, a bit like the Zaha thing with Palace, Celtic have been talking about it enough that they're clearly open to doing the deal. Because if they weren't talking about it, if you didn't hear Neil Lennon saying anything about it, he'd just be, people are asking the questions and he'd be just shutting those questions down. But he's been engaging with those questions, which means that clearly they're open to doing a deal.
Yeah.
So that gives me hope that a deal will come to pass. I was changing the talk slightly. One thing I wanted to talk about very briefly before we sort of finish up, to stop this podcast going on forever because obviously so much has happened, we also saw for the first time the Arsenal women playing on the same day as the Arsenal men at the Emirates Cup. Sadly, they lost to their feeder club, Bayern Munich. For those of you who don't know, Arsenal women have signed about 5 players from Bayern Munich in the last 2 or 3 years, including some of their star players, most notably Vivian Miedema, goal scorer extraordinaire. Lost 1-0, but more worrying was Danielle Carter, who's only just come back from having done I'm not sure if it's an ACL or a UCL, but a cruciate ligament injury.
She's recovering with the Berlin and Holden.
Yeah, she was stretched off yesterday. Yesterday, Jesus.
Yeah, I think it was on ankle.
Yeah. Well, they're not sure if it's an ankle or a knee. It's the kind of it's basic leg. They've got to assess where the worst damage is, but that would be a real shame from her, having just fought her way back to fitness. But it is a thing that cruciate ligament injuries are, I think it's either 3 or 4 times more likely amongst women footballers than male footballers.
That's a big difference.
And whether that's down to training and facilities, whether it's just down to physiology, I mean, there's no doubt that certain joints men have more strength in, because obviously men and women are built slightly differently, if they have different functions evolutionarily. But yeah, it's a real shame for her. The result wasn't really anything to concern anyone about, because unlike the men's game, in the women's game, when it comes to pre-season, we're always behind our European counterparts in terms of fitness and preparation. And also Arsenal had a lot of players who got to the latter stages of the World Cup, 4 or 5, who would normally be starting such games, who weren't. So whereas Bayern Munich had something much closer to their strongest team out, partly due to Germany women's embarrassing World Cup exit, in the same, well, not embarrassing, but they lost to Sweden earlier than they would have hoped to have done. But there's lots of new faces in the women's team this season. We'll get Sylvain to come on and talk to us specifically about that very soon, in the next couple of podcasts, and give us a lowdown about all the information about the new people who have joined the women's team, and also the reasons behind certain players leaving, like Dominique Bloodworth, for instance, who's one of our many Dutch players who's gone off to Wolfsburg, I think, in Germany. But largely, we've got a stronger squad last season than when we won the title with the women's team. So long may that continue, particularly for our challenge for the European Champions League. But given that we're a bit further behind in the women's preseason than the men's, we're not going to focus on that quite so much. But as I say, there will be more content coming on that front. Right. Now, before we wrap up, Anita, is there anything else that you're burning to talk about? Anything else that came up this week that you're... that has caught your attention that I might have missed?
I think that we have really gone through everything.
That's good. That's good. That means you get to have dinner tonight.
Yeah, it's really been an eventful week. We'll see how the next one will go. We have, what, 2 friend lists this week?
Yeah. To be honest, I will entirely confess that I don't know a great deal about them.
It's Barcelona is one. But...
Yeah, but I'm not sure where they're being played though. Is the Barcelona one actually happening in Spain? I know it's the Joan Gamper Trophy, which is like a standard pre-season thing Barcelona ever do, and that's on Sunday, 7 p.m. kickoff, it seems.
Mm-hmm.
And then this Wednesday evening at 6:30, we're playing Angers away in a friendly, who obviously we have a bit of a link to. It was them we sold Geoffrey Adelaide to, so maybe the friendly was related to that deal in some way. And of course, if Nicolas Pepe comes in, then there's going to be a further link to Angers, as they were a team that he played at for a period of time slightly earlier in his career.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to that transfer announcement.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they're going to have to really up their funky social media video game for that one, aren't they?
It will be hard to top the one last season with your Pierre, that is just...
Yeah, well, that's what people are saying. You know, if Pepe happens, he'd be our record signing. So they're going to have to top the Yo Pierre. I mean, either way, it's going to be better than Alexis Sanchez playing the piano.
Oh, anything's better than that.
Yeah, there's some Man United fans smirking off on Twitter, saying how Sanchez is going to score more goals than Pepe next season. I mean, which he might, but recent evidence would suggest that's not very likely.
I think Nketiah scored more goals than him last season.
Well, certainly Henry Mkhitaryan did, which is something we can take.
that's enough.
Yeah, which is probably the more important issue at this point. I mean, that's the thing, is we were gutted because we didn't sell Sanchez and when we could have done, and ended up not missing out on Lamar. But Mkhitaryan, for all the criticism he gets, had a better season than both Sanchez and Lamar, and possibly a better season statistically than the two of them put together, I think. So
yeah, even though he's not as exciting player as him, I think he does have his bad side, but he did good. He did well compared to those two.
Yeah, he's a funny one, Mkhitaryan, because he's capable of playing so well, but he sometimes looks like such a bloody amateur.
He looked well in highlights against Lyon.
It's true. He played well against Lyon. I mean, hopefully, it'd be interesting to see, if Pepe comes in, what's Mkhitaryan's role going to be? Is he just going to be your all-purpose cover for all the wide attacking positions and possibly cover at number 10? We've certainly got a lot more options. It's going to be very interesting to see. Yeah, last season Tom Lamar only got 2 goals and 3 assists in La Liga in 31 games, which suggests it wasn't an unmitigated success for them. So on that note, we'll leave with bated breath, waiting on Nicolas Pepe confirmation, and hopefully by the next time we've spoken, the Ivorian will have joined us to a great fanfare, or it'll be the most convoluted smokescreen ever, and we'll have picked up Zaha and Tierney for the same amount of money in a way that totally surprises everyone, and hopefully we'll also be in the process of picking up a centre-half. And hopefully we won't have any more injuries, particularly as it seems that Alex Lacazette's knock is a knock and no more than that, and he's out of his protective boot already, which is good news. All right, listeners, thanks for bearing with us to get this far. Hope you've enjoyed it. Hope you found it informative. If you've got any questions, mm-hmm. You want us to talk about anything or investigate anything or do any digging on anything, or you just want to send me abuse, get in touch at Daily Canon. That's at Daily Canon on Twitter. And we'd love to hear from you. Other than that, nothing else to say except for thank you to Anita.
It was really fun and eventful.
Yep, eventful and fun as always, Anita. And thank you for listening. Have a great week, everyone. Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.